What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Welcome to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Tonight, Jim, the world's only rock and roll talk show. We're going to talk about David Gilmour, a man you've written extensively about. You're the hugest Pink Floyd fan in the world. You are probably ecstatic that he has his first solo album out, in first album of any kind related to Pink Floyd.
In forever.
In over a decade.
The third of solo album of his career. I don't want to tip my hand, but I was ecstatic. we've also got a new record, a duo that you've always been fond of, the glam electronica combo Goldfrapp, and a conversation with the world's foremost authority, the best hip-hop author out there today,
absolutely,
Jeff Chang. But first, as always, we have some music news. Those are Oscar winners, the 3-6 Mafia, Memphis Trio, Juicy J, Crunchy Black, and DJ Paul took home the Academy Award last week for the Best Original Song. Not the first hip-hop song to win. That went actually to Lose Yourself by Eminem from the 2002 film 8 Mile. But they were the first hip-hop band to perform at the Academy Awards. It made quite an impact. Yeah. I don't think anybody knew what to make of them. The song they won for, Greg, is actually Your Life Story. It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp, based on Greg Kot's life experience. A pretty cool song from the movie Hustle and Flow, which I haven't seen yet.
I can't speak to the movie. The performance by 3-6 Mafia was the most exuberant thing I saw on that entire 3.5-hour broadcast.
They were really happy to be there.
They were very
really
happy to be there.
And so much so that they had willingly acquiesced to the ABC censors and changed a bunch of lines in the song. And it still wasn't enough because ABC thought they heard a word that was a no-no. It may or may not have been. And they got bleeped anyway. it's funny, Greg, to see hip-hop at the Academy Awards, which is the least street event in the universe. You know, I mean, everybody's taking home their million-dollar bags of goodies, and they're in designer clothes and all this stuff. And there's the guys from 3-6 up there giving this incredible acceptance speech, giving shout-outs to George Clooney.
We want to thank Keith Young, our choreographer.
Yes.
Man, help me out. Whole Sony Records, Lisa Ellis, our moms, our whole family.
Thank you, Jesus.
Selecto Hits for giving us a chance. The Academy, we love the Academy. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Gil Case. George Clooney, my favorite man. He showed me love when I first met him.
Memphis, Tennessee, we bring it home.
We out of here.
Yeah. Memphis, Tennessee.
I love it. Gangster rappers that love their mom. And these guys have been around for a while. They've put out a number of records, sort of emerging from that Memphis hip-hop underground. And again, part of the surge of Southern hip-hop, the Dirty South, that we're going to be talking about later on the show with Jeff Chang.
It was just like, wow, you know, hey, who let the riffraff in? And it's cool that they did.
Shape of a lion. Burn off sacrifice of pride and ride down to Mount Zion.
Never let it be said, Greg, that we don't embrace diversity here on Sound Opinions.
Modest Yahoo laying down some hardcore Orthodox Judaism. Jim, I think what we're hearing is the unlikeliest MTV hit of the last year, if not the decade.
It boggles my mind. I mean, we just can't ignore this phenomenon. It's so strange. Here you have a rapper, singer, doing an amalgam of hip-hop, dancehall, reggae, in full Hasidic garb, singing about Jewish spiritual themes and being embraced by the jam band audience, ushered onto the stage originally by Trey Anastasio of Phish, and drawing conservative Jewish fans, stoner jam band fans, your average just like dug it on MTV fan. I mean, what a weird thing.
Fire descends from on high in the shape of a lion. Burn the sacrifice of pride and ride on to Mount Zion. These are the opening lines on this guy's first studio record. I mean, there can be no doubt that he's coming from a spiritual Jewish perspective. 26-year-old Brooklyn-born Matthew Miller had a religious conversion apparently around the age of 20. Put out a live album last year, Live at Stubbs, a barbecue joint in Austin, Texas. Canny marketing on the part of his record company to say, okay, hey, he can do this in front of a Gentile audience as well and you know, score as well as the hardcore Jewish fans. And they were right. I mean, this album has gotten gold, sold over 500,000 copies. This week, the debut studio record called Youth is out, and it looks like a lot of people are talking, you know, top 40, possibly a top 10 album, selling out club and theater shows around the country. Certainly one of the most unlikely success stories of the last year.
I think, Greg, the fascinating thing is, what is Modest Yahoo singing about? You've been looking at these lyrics.
In the lyrics, he's quoting scripture, giving a form of Jewish prayer or pre-prayer.
He goes deeper than Madonna and the Kabbalah thing, clearly.
Comparison might be the way Bob Dylan approached the Bible in his Christian phase in the late 70s, early 80s. He was basically taking Bible verse and regurgitating it through the song lyrics. And I think Modest Yahoo is doing a similar thing. He's combining it with hardcore reggae music, hip-hop elements. He sings, he raps. So he's appealing to this weird and very unlikely cross-section of constituencies with this music, and has a gold record to show for it.
You're all I have and you're all that I need. Each and every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you. Yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me or the air that I breathe. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around, all around, they bring me down to negativity. But I believe, yes, I believe, I say that I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight and to the heights. Crown lights burning up out of the twilight. So thank you to my God, now I finally got it right. And I pray with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my mind. I give myself to you from the essence of my beginning. I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now.
Well, it's kind of fascinating that reggae, which was the music of the Rastafarian religion, but which was always talking about getting to Zion, getting to Israel, you know, the Israelites. It's interesting that he's adopting it for a completely different religion. As a sociologist, amateur sociologist, I applaud this, you know? I mean, bring it on. This is great. It's just, it's an interesting story. It's an interesting phenomenon. But I think the music kind of sucks. I'm not a huge fan.
Well, I'm surprised you as a 311 fan to dispute that this is no good. I mean, give me this over 311 any day, let me tell you.
All right,
imitating reggae music. This guy's got as much right as 311 to adopt reggae and rap and turn it into his own thing. Yeah, the music's kind of mediocre. It's not terrible. It's not great. It appears at this point to be sort of a novelty. I mean, is this going to still resonate a year or two from now? I have my doubts. I have serious doubts whether or not this guy can actually produce songs that radio is going to want to play years from now. But for now, he's the talk of the music world.
Well, we wanted to get some more perspective on this. So we talked to a couple of people trying to enlighten us on the phenomenon of Modest Yahoo.
We're talking with Whitney Lacefield, who is the Jewish United Fund campus coordinator for Hillel's of Illinois. And Whitney, rather than trying to explain that to our audience, I'd rather have you explain it to them. So if you could give us a brief synopsis of what that means.
I am the campus campaign coordinator, which means that I run the campaign on the college level. Roughly 17 campuses that include all the teeny tiny commuter schools within the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about college age Jewish kids, basically.
Exactly.
Are you, first of all, familiar with his music? And what do you think of it?
I went to his show back in November that was at the Metro, sold out. Was completely surprised it was sold out because I got my tickets through the Jewish Community Centers, the JCC, because I'm that cool. and, you know, just thinking it was just going to be a whole bunch of geeks like me, like professional Jews up in there, and then, you know, some bar mitzvah kids and, you know, yeshiva kids. But it was that and then some. It was really a trippy experience and, like, a huge, huge outpouring of just people that love that kind of music.
It's very rare, Whitney, that artists who market themselves as religious artists, and this is especially mm-hmm. true in the Christian music world, mm-hmm. Are able to then cross over into the mainstream. Do you get a sense that the Phish fans who are there, for example, are they listening to Modest Yahoo's lyrics? Because there is a very spiritual
right.
message in them.
You know what? I think that they are. I'm just not sure that they realize, like, some of the stuff. Like, I don't think that they realize what Hashem means.
Mm-hmm.
I think they, like,
I don't know.
Hashem, and Hashem is another word for God.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of like the idea of the spirituality and the soulfulness of it, and haven't bought into, you know, as they shouldn't unless they want to, you know, the Jewish aspect. It's very much how I feel people react to Kabbalah and this whole Kabbalah craze. It's, you know, no one really gets it, but they like the idea of it.
What about reconciling the spiritual message that he's putting across with the whole idea of presenting it in the context of a rock concert where booze
right.
and alcohol are sold and, you know, women could
right.
potentially be taking their tops off because they're so taken with this guy, you know?
Yeah.
How does that jibe?
It's a little creepy. I saw so many people, you know, lighting up weed and whatnot, and I'm like, you know, I get that, I guess, at a Phish concert, you know, it goes with the territory, but, you know, this guy is, you know, he's wearing tzitzit. He's got a yarmulke on. Like, this is, to me, very spiritual, and it's getting rid of the actual meaning for me. But I think if it reaches the masses and maybe gets people thinking about things, you know, as long as it's not talking about, you know, women taking their clothes off or talking about drugs, it's okay.
That's an interesting perspective. We appreciate your insight.
Thank you so much.
To get another viewpoint on Modest Yahoo and what the music means, I got an email the other day from a Chicagoan who took his son to the Modest Yahoo concert. Non-Jew. They went to this show because of the music. Let's talk to Eric Brightfield of Chicago.
What we're curious about is why you're interested in the music and how the religious themes of the lyrics translate to you, if at all.
You know, personally, you know, my wife's Catholic, mom Lutheran, my son is Catholic, and it really has no real bearing on it. It's just that now that my sons are into music at 11 to 14 and they have iTunes and, you know, they're mostly into Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, AC/DC, and lately Lynyrd Skynyrd, which is kind of gives me a little chuckle, so... I was just intrigued when I got this email invoice from iTunes that he bought this Modest Yahoo. I couldn't even pronounce it now, so I listened to it to make sure it wasn't anything too inappropriate, and I just really liked it. I just really had an instant reaction to it, and I went ahead and downloaded the rest of the Live at Stubbs album that night, and it was kind of funny. The next day he goes, "Dad, I think I bought a whole album by mistake. Can I cancel it?" And I said, no, I bought it. I really like this guy. I went to college in the 70s, so I loved reggae, Bob Marley, the Wailers, Eddie Grant, and that, and the Specials, so... To me, it was nostalgic. I, you know, didn't take much for me to like it.
You're a reggae fan, a hardcore reggae fan from the 70s.
No, I could
but
say
you like your reggae. You know your reggae.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to some classic reggae in your lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Here's
absolutely.
This 6'4" white Hasidic Jew from Brooklyn doing reggae, and you're saying this stuff is pretty good. He's doing a pretty good version of it.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, he's doing a pretty good version of it. And then, of course, there's the combination, like I said, the weird combination of the rap and the hip-hop, which I think my son's probably more attracted to. He's really attracted to the beatbox type thing. I don't think he's ever really seen that kind of thing, and that's why it was nice taking this show to see that it's really something they actually do, not something they do in the studio, that he was blown away by that.
You're not worried now that he's going to convert, though?
Well, I found a yarmulke in his back pocket this morning, but other than that, I know.
I think we can solve the Middle East here, Greg.
Yeah.
What we need is a Modest Yahoo mm-hmm. tour with some Sufi Farsi musicians.
Yeah.
And let's do it. You know, music brings everybody gets stoned, and then no more war in the Middle East.
We do it right in the middle of Jerusalem. I can see it right now.
Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric.
Thanks,
Eric. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Thanks.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune, and he's Jim DeRogatis of the Chicago Sun-Times. Take control of the atmosphere. Take control of the atmosphere. There's no reason I should breathe unless you're in the air. Yeah.
Speaking of religion and popular music, that is a song called Control from the debut album by a band called Mute Math. It's done very, very well in the Christian music underground. However, it appears that outside of the Republican Party, one of the worst things you can call anybody is a Christian. at least in the pop music world.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting story. This band had done very well for themselves on their own as an independent act and get signed to Warner Brothers. They think they've made the big time. Warner Brothers, though, chose to release the record on its Word Records imprint, which is a Christian music sub-label, which has driven Mute Math, the band, absolutely crazy. They're suing Warner Brothers and saying in their lawsuit that Word and Warner Brothers has caused them significant damage to their brand by naming them as Christians. Hey, don't be calling me a Christian, buddy. Them's fighting words.
Oh, my God. And the fact that they're calling their band a brand, that alone should tell you a lot about these guys. But, you know, they have a point. You automatically get sort of ghettoized in the record store. You get put in this little, you know, Christian religious music section in the back of the store instead of being marketed, you know, with the heavy hitters up at the front of the store.
And in the concert world.
In the concert world.
You're right.
But the touring circuit is very limited. And thirdly, radio doesn't want to touch you.
The reason we were talking about Modest Yahoo earlier is that he seems to be blowing up those artificial boundaries. It's going to be interesting to see if that then happens for Christian acts now, or, you know, for satanic acts, or pagan acts. I mean, we embrace all religions here.
Mute Math is not embracing theirs. I think that's the point
here.
No,
they're not. Don't be calling me a Christian in public.
Ali Farka Touré, the Malian guitarist who died last week at age 66 or 67. Nobody was quite sure what his birthday was. Born sometime in 1939. And the reason we're focusing on Ali Farka Touré in this ostensibly a rock and roll talk show is that Touré had quite a bit of influence on Western musicians. He was a genius guitar player and ended up...
Greg. Gurkel. Yeah. He played the Malian instrument known as the gurkel.
Well, he played many,
get
many
it straight there,
instruments.
Buddy.
He played many stringed instruments, and that was one of them. He mastered several. Self-taught, began playing guitar at age 10. What I love about Ali Farka Touré was that he never took himself that seriously in terms of, you know, music is the only thing I do. It was one of many things he did. He was like the mayor of various communities in his homeland. He was a farmer. When he made money from his records, he poured money back into the farm, back into the community. Many of his songs were about that community in Mali. His first record didn't come out in the United States until he was nearly 50 in the late 80s. And then he went on to collaborate with people like Ry Cooder and Jim Keltner. Talking Timbuktu, which was released in 1994, 3 years before the Buena Vista Social Club record that Ry Cooder did with those Cuban musicians, was one of the world music phenomenons of the 90s. Spent 32 weeks atop the Billboard World Music Charts, ended up winning a Grammy Award. Ali Farka Touré won yet another Grammy Award last year, just before he died. What appealed to Western audiences was that driving, propulsive rhythm that he had. Whereas a lot of West African guitarists were very lyrical and sweet, and don't get me wrong, Ali Farka Touré had all that in his finger-picking style. He also had these driving grooves in there, and you can really hear it. I think the best recordings done by Ali Farka Touré are the ones he made in the 70s while in France, and they're collected on a great record called Radio Mali. This is basically solo Ali Farka Touré on a song called Hani, and he's adding his own percussion with maracas and then slapping the back of his guitar to give it that very driving rhythmic feel. Farka Touré, dead at the age of 66 or 67, nobody's quite sure. It's a song called Honey. Later in the show, we're talking to hip-hop author Jeff Chang, going to take us on a coast-to-coast tour of the hip-hop underground. Plus, we'll have reviews of the new albums by David Gilmour of Pink Floyd and the electronica duo Goldfrapp on Chicago Public Radio's Sound Opinions. Yet and day, Gino Shama, no, 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 no.
Yeah. They're trying to censor the influencer. Yeah. Just makes me sicker. Influenza. Yeah, I abide by their censorship. Soon as they ride, I get back on my nigga shit. Can't reverse, so it is it. The boy game advanced. Compete the genesis. I broke bread with society's menaces. I dedicated sentences to the dead and sent hold your heads to my niggas that's doing sentences. I send condolences to the victims, but threats to the witnesses. Yeah.
We are listening to an up-and-coming Chicago artist, Lupe Fiasco. You're certain to hear more about him in the next couple of months. Let's face it, hip-hop is the predominant force in popular music today.
There's a tendency, though, Jim, to lump it all into this big homogenous mess and say all hip-hop's alike, or hip-hop is this, or hip-hop is that. And the reason it's still vital, the reason it's still creating new popular music every year, is this sense of regionalism. There is still a sense that, depending on where you are in the United States, there's a sense of sound and an aesthetic sensibility that goes with that location, whether it's New York, Los Angeles, now Chicago, Atlanta, Houston, going overseas now to London. Each of these urban centers has its own sound, and that's what's keeping hip-hop alive and still vital today.
We wanted to tap a professorial expert, if you will, actually a very great writer, Jeff Chang, who wrote a definitive history of hip-hop, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, but not to talk about the past so much as to give us a preview of the future.
Jeff, there's a sense that Chicago in some ways is the center of the hip-hop world, primarily through Kanye and people like Common, who have been around for more than a decade, Twista, who's had massive success the last couple of years. What's your take? What's the reality of this? Is this just a fad, or is an artist like Kanye here to stay?
I think Kanye is definitely here to stay. I personally am more interested in him as a personality than as an artist, actually.
Hmm.
But there's no doubt that he's got long coattails. You know, the Common record was great and really put another circle around Chicago as a place to listen for. I mean, people are definitely talking about the Rhymefest record out there. People waiting for Lupe Fiasco. So there's a buzz. I think there's a big buzz about Chicago that there hasn't been for 10 years since Common actually first came out, you know, and Twista first came out.
Jeff, we're going to have you take us on a coast-to-coast tour of what's going on in different cities. But before we move on, you said that you're more intrigued by Kanye West as a personality than as an artist. Greg and I have gone on a lot about his sonic interventions, you know, working with John Bryan and stuff. But from the personality angle, him coming out against homophobia,
yes,
him being a buppy, you know, which is,
yes,
really, we have not seen a buppy rapper, you know, yeah, before Kanye. What is it that's intriguing to you about that stuff?
Kanye has not just flown against what you would perceive to be the mainstream image of black masculinity that's put out in hip-hop. He has been very, very critical of it in the biggest places that you can imagine possible.
Which takes real guts.
It takes a lot of guts. And I think that he's been fearless in that respect, in the mold of folks like Chuck D,
yeah,
and Ice-T, you know, back in 1989. So from that standpoint, I've been very, very happy to see Kanye feeling his oats.
And for all the guff he gets about, you know, shooting his mouth off, I mean, that crystalline moment on national TV,
yeah,
where he says, you know, George Bush doesn't care about black people, whether you agree with him or not, I mean, it was something that was on a lot of people's minds, and nobody else in America was saying it.
Exactly.
And he did.
He did. He had the guts to go out and say it. And it had repercussions. You know,
mm-hmm,
it had policy repercussions that we're still talking about today.
Well, when you have the president's wife and Condoleezza Rice, you know, giving press conferences to disagree with you, people are listening.
And, you know, as far as a pop moment, I mean, that was a pop moment on par with what folks were saying in 1991 and 1992 right on the verge of the riots in Los Angeles, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was that important a moment in pop culture. And it's the kind of thing that made us, all of us aging hip-hop generationers, feel like, yeah,
yeah,
hip-hop,
boy,
still got it.
Well, and the response to that,
still got it.
The response to that statement was amazing, too, that underground hip-hop duo in Houston.
Legendary KO,
yeah,
you know, who went out and did that. And not just that, there was videos that were made. Two or three videos just popped up on the net backing that particular track, you know. So it became sort of this open source nightmare if you're on that side of it, or, you know, joy, breakthrough if you're on the other side.
All right, so this is a good way to start our tour. Let's talk about these scenes, these regional scenes. What's going on in Houston besides these two guys who built this great track inspired by Kanye,
yeah,
and what his comments were?
The Legendary KO, and they did this song called George Bush Doesn't Like Black People, and it was probably the most downloaded MP3 last year.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Houston really had a great year last year. Mike Jones, Paul Wall.
What it do is Paul Wall, I'm the people's champ. My chain light up like a lamp, cause now I'm back with the camp. I'm crawling similar to an ant, cause I'm low to the earth. People's feelings get hurt when they figure out what I'm worth. I got 84s poking out at the club, I'm showing out. I'm a player, ain't no doubt, hoes wanna know what I'm about. Biggest diamonds off in my mouth, princess cuss all in my chain. Wood grain all in my range, dripping stains when I switch lanes. Switch the name, it's still the same. Switch a house or switch a blast. Mike Jones, he running the game in magnificent. Sent by this cash, Michael Watts, he made me hot. Hard work took me to the top. G-Dash took me to the lot. He wrote a check and bought a drop.
You know, all of these folks kind of blowing out of the scene there. And I think Houston, along with the rest of the South, one of the things that's underrated again about these scenes is the infrastructure. You know, the fact that these folks can still go out and play out there, the fact that they've got local distributors that are out there, the fact that they've got DJs on radio stations that are commercial, that are supporting them, was huge. And it led to this sort of bubbling effect for all these years. You know, Houston, Atlanta, and now the Bay Area are all these scenes where it's been several years in the making. And these are holes that are opening up in sort of media monopoly situations. You know, four or five years ago, everybody was complaining, and rightly so, and still are complaining that it was the same five songs everywhere, and they were mostly all New York rappers. Well, last year's the year that there was a revenge of these local regional scenes, and I think it's going to continue to move on that way.
All right, so we're running through the regions. Houston's obviously had a huge year in 2005. Atlanta has been dominating this whole concept, the Dirty South. You keep hearing that over and over again, especially in the last 4 or 5 years. Outkast, huge success out of there. But what is it about Atlanta that has made it, in a lot of ways, I think, the hip-hop epicenter after New York thing, then the L.A. thing? I think Atlanta sort of took over after that. What happened?
Atlanta's just got a continuum of artists that are out there really, really innovating stuff. And they've got a very vibrant local scene that, you know, like Houston, like these other scenes, like the Bay Area, supports its folks. So you've got snap music, you know, it's basically a beat and a wisp of a melody and nothing else, hardly. You know, the D4L Laffy Taffy, the much derided, but I love that song. I don't care what anybody says. I think that's a great, great pop single. And then there's the trap stuff, you know, trap music being a new term for music about hustling, about selling crack or, you know, that kind of thing. And that's Young Jeezy and T.I. and all those folks that have been doing their thing.
Is crunk already faded?
I think we're in the post-crunk phase.
Post-crunk?
Yes.
Lil Jon can only grunt so many times over the same synthesizer bleep, right?
You know, but Lil Jon is still alive and kicking, and he's going to be there for a very, very long time. Lil Jon has gone hyphy, you know, and hyphy is sort of the faster version of crunk. Faster, a little bit less dense, but just about partying and having fun.
Ooh. Tell me when to go.
Tell me when to go.
Tell me when to go.
Tell me when to go. Go.
Well, you know, Jeff, you raise a good point, because a lot of people who denigrate hip-hop or don't understand it, you know, they hear a snippet of it on the radio, and it's just noise, you know, the classic complaint. I mean, Benny Goodman was just noise in 1935, you know, to some people. But you hear that in the context of a club over a big speaker system, and you watch a crowd explode.
Exactly.
A 50 Cent song that I never would have thought twice about on a record comes on in a club, and you see the reaction of the crowd, and you get caught up in that, the bass tones and everything taking over, and it's a completely different experience. And the Lil Jon thing, I think the culture of that is in a similar kind of approach.
And that's how folks have reactions to Lil Jon's stuff, to the hyphy stuff, to Laffy Taffy, for goodness sake. You know?
And guys like Young Jeezy are essentially singing about clubs, about, you know, drug dealing and clubs. the lyrics are talking about it. The music is meant to be played in a club. It's not meant to be played over a little tiny iPod. It's something that you want to hear over those big booming speakers.
It's true. I mean, the Jeezy stuff, that's I didn't really get Jeezy for a long time until I started playing it loud in my room.
Guess who's been back? Still smell the blow on my clothes like Krispy Kreme. I was cooking the molds. Like horseshoes, I was tossing the molds. Time to re-up, gotta recycle the flow. I'm emotional, I hug the block, ayy. I'm so emotional, I love my Glock. Chance rules everything around me, so what's realer? By this thriller, call me a ghost face killer. It's kinda hard to be drug free, but Georgia Power won't give a nigga lights free. Switch hustles been killing them ever since. If you can't tell the truth, dawg, it only makes sense. When they play that new G's, all the dope boys go crazy. Now watch the dope boys go crazy. I pop my collar, then I swing my chain. If you catch me in the club, they been doing my thing.
And then I was like, oh, I get it. You know, he's trying to infuse a certain kind of grandeur to the hustling game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in that sense, he's not doing too much different from what the Ghetto Boys are doing, you know, a good 10, 15 years ago.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show on Chicago Public Radio. I am Jim DeRogatis of the Chicago Sun-Times. My partner is Greg Kot of the Tribune.
Hip-hop's an art form that eats its young. And, you know, you have a hit 1 minute, the next year you're done, unless you come up with something new and fresh every time. And Houston and Atlanta and a lot of these southern cities that are exploding in the wake of the dominance by Los Angeles and New York for decades, isn't a lot of it just the sonics? I mean, they're bringing a new take to what hip-hop can be and how it should sound.
I think it's that, too. The aesthetics of Snap and Trap are really interesting to me because they're going back to this very stripped-down sound that you heard during the early 80s, out of New York, for instance, with Run-DMC leading into Marley Marl, or the early gangster rap, the Ice-T, early Dr. Dre productions on NWA in 87 and 88 and 89, before they really began to blow up, and Dre began to layer a lot of stuff on. Basically just drum machine, snaps, you know, the whisper of a melody going on, you know, is sort of what they've been taking it back to. And that's something that's been several years in the making as well. You can kind of trace it back to what the Neptunes did with the Clips, with Grindin'.
From ghetto to ghetto, the backyard to yard, I sell it whip on whip, it's off the hard. I'm the neighborhood pusher, call me subwoofer, cause I pump bass like that, Jack. On or off the track, I'm heavy cuz, ball to your fathers, you can duck to the Fetty Gov. Sorry my love, but I'm seeing through these eyes. Benz convoys with the wagon on the side. Only big boys keep deuces on the ride. Gucci Chuck Taylor with the dragon on the side. Man, I make a buck while I scram. I'm trying to show y'all who the fuck I am. The Jews is flirting, be damned if I'm hurting. Legend in two games like I'm Pee Wee Kirkland. Platinum on the block with consistent hits. While Pharrell keep talking this music-ish.
I love that. I think it's really interesting, and it actually relates, the aesthetics relate to what's happening in this country as well. It's a situation where in many cities, crime is back on the rise, drug use is back on the rise, and there's a sort of hollowing out of, you know, the society in these neighborhoods. And so it makes sense for folks to move from these very lush produce types of sounds to these very stripped down basic types of tones. So I think that in a lot of respects, it hit people in the music industry by surprise, but it had to happen in a lot of ways because there's a sense now that the tastemakers in New York City really aren't getting it right. You know, we just got the new books back and Hot 97 was knocked out of the top perch by a new reggaeton station.
For those who don't know, Hot 97 is the leading hip-hop station in New York, and reggaeton is essentially Spanish hip-hop with touches of world beat thrown in.
It's a dancehall hip-hop hybrid given a uniquely Puerto Rican and Latino tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that You know, in L.A., the same thing happened. When the reggaeton station debuted there last year, it knocked all of these urban stations out of the box.
Well, before we get away from L.A. and New York, if reggaeton is on the rise in both coasts, are L.A. and New York otherwise in decline as the hip-hop meccas?
I think so. But yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like New York took it on the chin last year. And there was a lot of sort of browbeating about that in New York. But for me, man, there was a lot of really interesting stuff happening in the rest of the world. And it was another sort of big decentering type of situation, just like when NWA took it from, you know, New York back in 89 and when the West Coast took it in 92 and 93 away from New York.
What about L.A.? Is there any life out there?
I don't think L.A. is actually on the cutting edge right now. And again, this has to do with a situation of media monopolies dominating the scene there. The stations there have recently gotten rid of their most popular sort of underground themed shows on the big stations. And there's been a lot of outcry in the community about it. But there hasn't been avenues, you know, in commercial radio in one of the biggest markets in the country for grassroots folks for years and years. And as a result, you haven't seen a lot of new development of artists in those areas. There's a huge gap that people have to make in order to make it from that local level, that thing of being able to sell your first pressing through in 1 week, you know, in the neighborhood, to getting to a level of somebody like The Game. And The Game was many, many years in the making and many millions of dollars in the making before he blew up. So it's hard to class The Game as a breakthrough for L.A.
Yeah, and he had all of Dr. Dre's might behind him, right?
And at one point, 50 Cent. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So.
You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune, and he's Jim DeRogatis of the Chicago Sun-Times.
Let's talk about London and some of these other scenes around the world, where hip-hop's going there. MIA made so much news last year, and you have people like Dizzy Rascal and The Streets. I mean, Cockney rap, you know, this guy, The Streets, you know, the Cockney Eminem. I mean, how weird is that?
Yeah.
What do you see happening over there and people appropriating, and, you know, much less, you know, Japan and Africa?
Gosh, the grime scene's really interesting to me. You know, you've got these really goofy breakout type characters like Lady Sovereign, who I just can't wait to hear her.
She's
record.
A hoot.
Yeah, make way for the SOV.
People are really excited about her.
She's just, I mean, she to me, she's the real thing. You know, she has all that amazing energy, and the records are great, and they work on a very basic, simple pop type of level. Random, you know. Songs like that can really, really work, I think.
Everybody in the club getting tipsy. Yo, puff that, just wine like a gypsy. Can't see straight like I got one eye. Your bottle open, oh mine. Let's get started. Move around, like off to karate. Ooh, ish, my word plays nasty. Ooh, ish, don't put it past me. Move, ditch, get out the way. Nah, never that, I'm here to stay. Flow lazy, pick the pace up when I flow less hazy.
These types of scenes are evolving at a very, very fast rate. And that's the thing about hip-hop, is that the sounds may be completely varied and vastly different, but the rate of change is the thing that's kind of the constant. The fact that folks on the street are the ones who are possessing it, that you're going to, like, I'm going to go down to the corner this summer, and I'm going to hear something completely different that's going to blow my mind again, whether that corner be here in Chicago, whether it be in Brooklyn, whether it be in my neighborhood in Berkeley.
Or in Africa.
Or in Africa, absolutely.
You know, it's interesting you bring up that point, because when you think about the major forms of pop music in North America in the 20th century, they all started out as African-American art forms. You know, jazz, blues, rock and roll.
It's the story of American culture.
And it's about appropriating that, and, you know, the broader culture appropriates it and makes it their own thing, inevitably capitalizes on it commercially. We saw the first inklings of that in the hip-hop world with the Beastie Boys in the 80s, and it's continued on to where now we have, you know, this burgeoning scene in England right now appropriating this art form. So, Jeff, the question is, do you see the burnout occurring where, you know, this thing just gets played out and the money becomes Paramount, and the creative thing just stops in its tracks.
Well, I think the difference between what's happening to hip-hop now and what happened to rock during the 80s, I mean, there are a lot of similarities, right? You know, we talk a lot about how radio is monopolized now by, you know, Clear Channel and a handful of other companies. The same complaints are happening during the 80s around rock, and indie rock was seen as a reaction to that. But what the difference is now is that the tables have turned in a lot of ways to where big companies understand that they have to be moving very quickly. And so why hip-hop has been so valuable is because it changes from the block level, and that filters up. And it's not the type of thing where change is filtering down from the top like it was during the 80s, where it's like, okay, it's about the big Eagles release this year.
Yeah.
You know, it's about the long run this year. You know? and
the latest Bob Seger opus.
Exactly, the follow-up to Night Moves. So that's the difference, and I think that hip-hop is going to definitely change into something else at some point. My kids are going to wake up one day and be like, Daddy, hip-hop's whack, or hip-hop is whatever the word for whack is that we use now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's going to be something that I'm going to go out on the block, and they're going to be out there dancing their weird dance and listening to their weird music and stuff, and it's not going to be something I'm going to recognize anymore, and I'm going to be like, oh, my goodness, you know, what happened? It's just a whole different kind of a switch that's occurred since the 80s to now. And again, the power of it is that it's happening now, and that's the thing that can't be bottled by these big companies, that can't be forced fit by these companies.
Well, it's a philosophical discussion, Jeff, and mm-hmm. this is, I suppose, one of the things that gets me branded a rockist when mm-hmm. I try to draw the connections between Chuck Berry, Public Enemy, and Nirvana, you know. But if there is, at the bottom of it all, is there a universal thing that is hip-hop, no matter what the decade, no matter what the sound, no matter if it's in China or the Bronx? If you had to, you know, this probably would have been a better first question, right, Greg? But if you had to get to the core of what is the universal of hip-hop that makes Lady Sovereign, you know, part of the same tradition of music as, you know, Fat Joe, you know, what is it?
Well, I mean, it's a combination. You know, you could say there's a certain sort of vocabulary, a sound vocabulary. There's a certain sort of method of pastiching sound. You know, you could say there's a certain kind of outlook, you know, to it that it has to do with stealing, rhyming and stealing, as the Beastie Boys put it. You know, for me, you know, as I try to define it in the book, it's a generational outlook that kind of unites folks around the world. If there's a sonic sort of core to it, I don't know how to boil that down into like 10 sentences or less.
No, I would disagree. It's not about the sonics, it's about the attitude. You know, the same attitude that they had on the Bronx, you know, in 79 in the playground is there today in London in the grime scene, and it's there in China, in Tiananmen, for God's mm-hmm. sake. And it's basically a like, you know, we're sick and tired of being beaten down. Our response is going to be partly to party and partly to get angry.
No, that's actually really, really nice. I really like the way you put that.
Hey, thanks for coming in, Jeff. It was great having you on Sound Opinions.
Oh, man, thanks for having me.
And all across the world, the fly ladies and girls tell me they loving it. East Coast say they loving it. Midwest say they loving it. Old world say they loving it. It's not a big
If you want an explanation of what Jim and I just said, and believe me, you're going to need it sooner or later, check out the footnotes at soundopinions.com. We're going to be right back on Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio with some record reviews, including the new one from ex-Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour.
Yeah.
Ah, those vaguely Pink Floydian sounds are, in fact, the first solo album from Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour in 22 years. We need to fill in the backstory here, because there's a long backstory, and as I made this point in the paper when I reviewed the album, to be a Pink Floyd fan today in 2006 is possibly one of the least fulfilling fan positions in all of rock and roll, because you're living with this chronic, unrealistic hope that just maybe Pink Floyd will reunite. Generally speaking, I'm against old fogey geezers, millionaires, getting back together and revisiting their glory days. Except with Pink Floyd, you know, nobody ever knew what they looked like anyway. It was these four guys who weren't particularly virtuosos who made this genius music that, in the space between your headphones, transported you to worlds that existed only in the imagination. I think it's one of the greatest careers in rock history, the evolution of four Pink Floyds, you know, from the very early days, psychedelic pop in the mid-60s of Sid Barrett, to the kind of proto-jam band of the late 60s, early 70s, to the platinum Pink Floyd that we know and love. Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, Animals, and The Wall. And then you get this split. Roger Waters, the bassist and lyricist, primary songwriter, he continued as a part Pink Floyd without any melody, a lot of ideas, while Gilmour and the other guys in the Floyd, Nick Mason and Rick Wright, continued as a Pink Floyd with no ideas, and the songs weren't so great either. Yet last year, they gave us this hope. At Live 8, there they were. On stage again, these four fat old millionaires sounding incredible. It was a great moment,
yeah,
right,
it was.
Greg? You and I were both high on that music, and you hoped that maybe they would get it together. No, it promptly fell apart again. One of the most acrimonious splits in rock history, the three instrumentalists versus Roger Waters, the lyricist and the bass player, and now Gilmour gives us this solo record. Now, I am such a Pink Floyd freak. I will defend the first two David Gilmour solo albums.
Wow.
A little sleepy, but there's moments. This one, I had some hopes. You know, Gilmour is rock royalty. When he's taking a vacation, he goes and plays with Paul McCartney on Run Devil Run. He can still play some fiery guitar. And On an Island, his first solo album in 22 years, had some impressive help. He tapped Roxy Music guitarist Phil Manzanera to co-produce with him. Rick Wright shows up to play some organ, the Pink Floyd guy, and sing a little bit. Robert Wyatt of the Soft Machine is singing backing vocals. And you got Graham Nash and David Crosby. Talk about a duo backing you up on harmonies. He wrote a lot of the songs with his wife, Polly Sampson, and that, you know, triggered a little alarm bell, because the division bell and a momentary lapse of reason, those two horrible post-Roger Waters Pink Floyd albums, were co-written by Gilmour and her. But nevertheless, I opened the shrink wrap on this with great anticipation. Let's hear a little something, and then we're going to talk about where it went.
Start is where we end. We step out sweetly with nothing planned. Along by the river, the swans, and then over the footbridge to the woods beyond. We walk ourselves weary, you and I.
That's David Gilmour from On an Island with a song called Where We Start, which is actually one of my favorite moments on this record. I think it's a lot like early 70s soundtrack Pink Floyd from records like More or Obscured by Clouds. But that's as good as it gets.
Yeah, this is... I had to wake up just to comment here, Jim, because this record really did put me to sleep. All the signposts of classic Floyd are here. The very stately, grand, eloquent guitar solos, the keyboard atmospherics, you know, the kind of drifting, melodic development, but it's really slow developing. I can just picture him strolling arm in arm with his wife in the English countryside, walking into the autumn of their years together. And they wrote this album together. And we get lyrics like, "We waltz in the moonlight and the embers glow so much behind us."
Shamelessly,
still far to go.
So blue, midnight moon shines for you. I know.
It's dull and uninteresting to me. I mean, to my mind,
yeah, you're right.
This is a record that he phoned in so many ways. I mean, the idea of him showing inventiveness and modernizing his sound is to pick up a saxophone in one song and say, "Hey, I'm going to learn how to play this instrument." And the other eerie moment, Jim, in this record, I don't know if you noticed this, but there's a song called "A Smile" on here in which you mentioned his work with Paul McCartney a few years ago. I think he's trying to sound like Paul McCartney on this particular song. You know, the wistful acoustic Paul McCartney. Mm-hmm. And it's like eerie. So this is the innovation we get. David Gilmour's learned how to play the saxophone, and he's trying to channel Paul McCartney. Otherwise, we're talking about some really slowly developing melodies to the point where I just think it's one of the most dreadfully boring albums by a major rock act I have heard in decades.
I'm admitting to my full-on geekdom. I was actually bona fide excited to hear this record. And it breaks my heart. I have no idea why he even bothered. You know, and then meanwhile, you have Waters. You know what Waters' last project was? It's an opera called Ca Ira, which is a operatic take of the French Revolution. Both of these cases, both solo Gilmour and solo Waters, you have music that is more horribly inflated than the famous Floating Pig that these guys had in their heyday in concert. You know, never in rock history have two guys needed each other as much. It's like, bury the hatchet, fellas, or give it up. Don't subject us to more records like On an Island, which I have to say, and it hurts me, is a trash it. It's a quadruple trash it.
Yeah.
One for each member of Pink Floyd record.
Yeah. I think we should just burn the trash can, too, with this record in it.
Blow it up. Yeah. Blow it up like the Spitfire that crashed into the wall, you know?
Can you picture this icy electro vixen sort of leaning back on a, you know, a synthesizer and Marlena Dietrich for the 21st century? This is what Goldfrapp is today.
Doing that leg flash thing where you lounge across the top of a synthesizer isn't quite as effective as on top of a grand piano.
Whatever they're doing, they're attempting to channel that sort of vibe. This is the British duo of Alison Goldfrapp and Will Gregory on their third album, Supernature. That's a song called Beautiful from that record. And what they're doing is very effective commercially. This record came out in the UK last year, spawned a number of top hits, just being released in the United States now. What they're doing is combining that classic Euro disco sound. Remember Donna Summer, Giorgio Moroder? Combining it with a little bit of glam rock, this sort of bedazzled kind of version of rock music and all the glitter and glam effects that go into it, the imagery being as important as the music itself, and turning into this sort of decadent disco act. This is not, however, how Goldfrapp started. 5 years ago, they had a debut album named Felt Mountain, which was a much more of a chilled ballad record, kind of an otherworldly orchestrated pop record that really didn't sound like anything else that came out in the year 2000, and I still think is the best thing they've ever done. They didn't have a lot of commercial success with that record. They've since gone to this Euro disco thing on a record called Black Cherry in 2003, even more so on the new record, Supernature. But I far prefer the sound that they channeled on that first record. Alison Goldfrapp as a singer, I think, was unequaled doing that. Oddly enough, they touch on that in one or two places on the new record. My favorite track from Supernature is a song that very much references that very first album. It's a track called Time Out from the World. Let's hear it on Sound Opinions. Thank you.
That's Goldfrapp, a track called Time Out from the World from their third album, Supernature. Greg, you have been shoving Goldfrapp down my throat since that first album, and I've been disagreeing with you consistently ever since. Every once in a while, I think your libido gets the better of your critical judgment. I think you just like this chick, you know what I'm saying? But I think this is actually, I know where you're going. I think you're going to tell me that you don't think this is their finest record. You already said you thought the first one was the best. I think this is the one where they got it right. I thought the second album was too much Eurodisco. I thought the first album was too snoozy. This album is kind of like Portishead, if it had a beat, or Kylie Minogue, and there was actual more substance there. By no means do I love this, but I do think it's Goldfrapp's finest record, and it's got some charms to it. I would definitely, on the patented Sound Opinions rating scale of buy it, burn it, and trash it, I would burn this record.
Well, I might burn it. I'm tempted to trash it because I just think this Eurodisco thing has been done to death and done better. There's nothing here to get fired up about.
There's a song that rips off Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky.
Yeah, it sure does.
Didn't get you going?
And also, they rip off T-Rex, Ride a White Swan, a song called Ride a White Horse.
I'm going to remember this, man. When you turn on an artist, you turn hard.
Well, let's face it. The record isn't nearly as good as the debut. Felt Mountain is the one. And I think they sold out. They said, hey, we can make a lot more money doing this Eurodisco thing. And they're just not that good at it.
So I say burn it and you say trash it, Greg?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't see this record as being nearly as alluring as Felt Mountain, and to me, they're going downhill fast. Give us a call. Let us know what you thought about tonight's show. If you've got any disagreements or any opinions to add to our Sound Opinions, give us a call at 1-888-859-1800. That is available to you 24/7. Same with the message board at soundopinions.com. And there are also helpful footnotes on there to help you understand all the stuff that Jim and I talked about tonight, even though sometimes we don't understand ourselves what we're talking about.
This is true. Next week, it'll be pretty easy to understand. We're going to do some buried treasures, one of our favorite kinds of shows, music you probably haven't heard, but you really need to. Got some thank yous to say. Our executive producer is Tori Southside in the house, Malatia. Our managing producer and director is Todd Bachman. Our producer is Matt Spiegel. Associate producers are Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. Our legal guru is Dino Armiros. And Joe Dassault gives us lots of technical assistance. And in the spirit of Matzis Yahu, Greg, shalom and assalamu alaikum.
Shalom, Jim.